Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined on this fine Wednesday afternoon by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I am invigorated because we're heading towards the end of the year and possibly civilization, you know, so good one, bad one, I'll leave it up to listeners to decide.
Indeed. I must say I'm very much looking forward to December after what has been a difficult year for a lot of people. And I'm also joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
No, I'm okay, but I seriously want to see the terms and conditions for 2021.
Yeah, no, I thought back at the beginning of about a month ago to everyone who made a New Year's resolution this year and how awkward that must feel now, because I suspect there weren't too many of them that were fulfilled. Right. So let's get stuck into things by talking about something that Terence has written. And this is a report on something that we think is extremely important, and that is property rights, but more specifically, property rights and women in Africa. Terence, why don't you take us through what you said, and then we'll get into a little bit of a discussion about it.
Well, essentially, the question of property rights in Africa is itself a big one. You know, you have a very confused system, a very confused mix of systems of land holding, but and other forms of property ownership, which you know go through very a pre-colonial, sometimes even religious. Systems of property holding. You have the impact of the systems that the colonial powers left. You know, whether it's English law in the case of Kenya or the continental system in the case of Senegal or Mozambique. You then have what was introduced after after the colonizers left, and in places like Mozambique, for instance, that you know attempt to create a sort of communist society. All of this, you know, has made the question of property rights, you know, a particularly confused and contentious one. But the question of where women fit into this is one that's never been satisfactorily settled. And you know, just to explain what I mean there. Women are entitled to, and in terms of various instruments of the African Union and individual countries' constitution, no lesser rights than men. But in practice, this is very seldom the case. Legal systems have moved across the continent. My work looked at the countries in sub-Saharan Africa and moved towards equalizing rights for men and women. So outright discrimination, you know, a woman may not. It still exists in places much more than we would like, but that is being dismantled. The problem comes in how this percolates down to people's day-to-day experiences, the actual ability to hold property. Now, one of the activists I spoke to in the preparation of the report put it quite bluntly that there is often this assumption across the continent, and I suppose in other parts of the world too, the idea that women have often been seen themselves as kind of a form of property. So how can property own property? I mean, it's a dreadful way to phrase it, but that is a reality. You have countries like Rwanda, which have gone to great lengths to introduce a, you know, gender equity in their politics and in their law. But you often find that this is not enforced in practice because effectively officials who are in charge of implementing it just don't agree with it, don't understand the law. Then there's the question of how do you enforce it when there is a transgression, and there's often just practical impediments. You know, how do you get to, cover the 200 or 300 kilometers to the nearest court, wait in line for days and days and days, and then perhaps see your case dismissed because, you know, you actually need a lawyer to represent you. So we have these structural and attitudinal impediments, and then of course there's the issue of customary law and social conventions. The idea that this is the way that things were done in the past. This is the way our culture does them, and these remain remarkably resilient. So much so that there are instances. Mali is an example where there were attempts to introduce laws to expand the rights of women to own and control property, which were defeated by, you know, quite legitimate, if I can say, as grassroots activism, including by many women who felt that this was out of sync with their culture. Unfortunately, you know, as long as these circumstances prevail. African women will find themselves, to a greater or lesser extent, excluded from proper participation in economies. And that, of course, has knock-on effects. It restricts your ability to pursue a more lucrative career. In the case of landholding, for instance, we know from empirical studies that where women are able to own the land as opposed to having it sort of conditionally assigned to them through spouses or through a village elder, they generally switch into more lucrative cash crops, or they can they're secure in their ownership, so they don't have to be there all the time. They can go out and start selling things. You know, it opens up new opportunities. It also gives women options. So when they find themselves in damaging or abusive relationships, having the means or the option for self sustainability does give you an opportunity to exit. That's something I think that is very important given the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. So, you know, but all of this, of course, gets down to one fundamental point. Does the government actually believe in property rights as a concept? You know, if it doesn't, then all of the above fall away.
Right. So I want to pick up on something there, which is, Herman, do you think that perhaps property rights, considering what Terence just laid out and how important they can be for, you know, doing things like actually, and I think many people don't realize this, helping to fight against something like abusive relationships and gender-based violence, that kind of stuff. Do you think that property rights have been ignored because a lot of the space around women empowerment is very much colonized by a kind of very sort of left-wing NGO type of organization or outlook? And that has sort of stunted the discussion in this particular sphere. What's your view, Herman?
I think you're absolutely right on that score, because I think the thing about, you know, life, liberty, and property is it really doesn't discriminate. It's you know, this Lockean recipe for functioning society is, you know, government should exist to protect life, to protect liberty, and to protect property. It doesn't say the liberty of certain men or certain women or certain people. It essentially has this built into its measurement and its recipe for societal success. And I think if you focus on those things, you achieve greater social upliftment for everyone. I think this might be slightly tangential, but I think it's quite telling that the Conservative Party in the UK, the one party that has not indulged in things like all-female shortlists for MPs, is the only party to have had two female prime ministers before the most obviously left-wing identitarian party, the Labour Party, hasn't even yet had a permanent female leader. So there is something to be said for if you want to improve someone's life, whether they are female, whether they are black, whether they are Christian, whether they are gay, whether they are any form of any identity under the sun. The core fundamentals of protected life, protected liberty, and remain very much the core of success. And based on that core of success is what liberalism really has a proud record of building on. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think it goes to the heart as to why I don't think one should measure policies expressly on how can you uplift a certain identitarian segment. You should have essential basics in place that make sure social upliftment happens for everyone. And as Terence points out in this report, women unnecessarily being not included in that protection of life, liberty, and property really undermines their social upward mobility.
Terence?
Yeah, you know, one of the one very interesting conversation I had was with a lady named Laura Nyirinkindi. She is a Ugandan lawyer, head of a sort of legal federation in East Africa, and I asked her about Uganda's experience, because the Ugandan government has also stressed, like the Rwandans, the incorporation of women into decision making structures, and she says, you know, the incentives, you know, all become wrong. So, you know, don't expect, because you're more women, you're necessarily going to have going to see these issues dealt with. And she said she put it very well. She said that what we need to move from is assumptions about critical mass to critical actors, people who are willing to who are willing to take this up and give it and give it serious attention, which. You know, and you know, as I argue, this is not something that should be left to women or to women's organizations. Those of us interested in economic growth and participation, men or women, should be equally concerned about it.
Right, I think that's a really good point. You know, one of the it's not just, you know, an abridgment of people's rights, but it also hurts everyone in the society when women are excluded from the economy, because of course they're 50% of the potential workforce. And so when you keep them out of property, when you keep them out of the workforce, when you keep them out of education, you're basically cutting off one of your arms if you're a country.
Correct.
I do think though that also your point about sort of, you know, representation in parliament, it's not a great metric, and Herman mentioned this as well, with the sort of all-female list of representatives. You look at the lists of countries in the world with the highest percentage of women in their parliaments and legislatures. It's places like, you know, Rwanda, Cuba, Bolivia, Mexico, Namibia. South Africa is actually in the top 10 there. And yet women face a lot more discrimination in our societies than they do in societies that are perhaps have fewer women in parliament. So it's not some sort of magic switch that, you know, you get more women into politics and suddenly everything comes right. You need to fix these more fundamental issues, you know, like state capacity to enforce laws, not just pass them. All right, well, I think that's pretty good. Let's move on to our next topic for today. And this is actually something that Herman flagged from Twitter, which I'm just struggling to find now at the moment. It was from, here it is, Derek Hunnicle of the ANC. And this, he was commenting on a news article where someone said, the SAFM said, SA-born tech entrepreneur Elon Musk has topped Microsoft founder Bill Gates to become the world's second richest man. So this happened a few days ago. And Derek Hunnicle commented, "Of course we celebrate his success. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if he plows some of his wealth back into the land of his birth?" So, Herman, let me go to you. And I think there's two questions here. And the first one I want to ask you is should Elon Musk be sending back his money here and investing in South Africa? And what even would that look like? And the second question is, would Elon Musk ever have become as wealthy as he is if he had stayed in South Africa?
Well, I really do feel like this, you know, special needs kids here, because I can just say no and no. These are the really, really easy questions. Should Elon Musk bring his money back to South Africa invested here? Of course not. You want to invest it in a place where it can either hold its value in a turbulent global situation of investments, or you where it can grow. And South Africa is neither conducive to stability nor attractive to growth. So the first question, obviously, we can answer very easily. No. South Africa, certainly we're in a situation where parasitic government has run out of taxpayers' money to spend, as Thatcher warned socialists always do. But now for the survival of the internal party structures, the patronage network of the ANC, they desperately need cash so that they can keep the patronage network fully operational. And for that, they, of course, need to get their hands on assets. And as I've said many, many times in the past, a state, a government can only get money, as it were, through five options. It can raise taxes, not an option for South Africa. The South African taxpayer is under immense strain. Two, it can cut expenditure, not politically feasible because of the constituency of the tripartite alliance, especially COSATU and the unions. Three, it can seek international borrowing, but our bonds are now, you know, even further into junk status than they were a few weeks ago. So the two things that essentially remain for government needing cash is you can print money, hence the nationalization of the Reserve Bank is such an important thing to oppose because it will print money and cause hyperinflation by diluting the power of the money in your pocket or bank account, or then lastly, it can grab assets. And if we look at expropriation without compensation, that is what it is. Nationalization of the healthcare sector to access those funds, that's what it is. Through the NHI, through the expropriation bill, through Section 25 of the Constitution, amending that through Regulation 28, prescribed assets. That's essentially what is happening here. So why shouldn't Elon Musk invest in South Africa under these circumstances? Because the money will be very, very vulnerable to the clutches of a greedy and grubby little government stitch-up between corporates and the ANC here. So that's in answer to the first question. No. Secondly, the question is, would it have been possible for Elon Musk to achieve these levels of success here in South Africa? Absolutely not. That is perhaps quite clearly illustrated in why he went to America in the first place. South Africa has decades, possibly even a century, of discouraging free enterprise and discouraging the development of skills in many instances. And I think Mr. Elon Musk was those were some of the significant push factors that saw him go to America and become, as it were, I think, what now, the second richest man in the world. So in answer to your first question, should he bring his money back? No. Would he have been able to get that money in the first place had he been here in South Africa? No.
So, Terence, one of the things bundled into Derek Connacombe's sentiment here is this kind of appeal to patriotism. He must give his wealth back to the land of his birth. And there's sort of, a number of implications there. One is that, the land is, in a sense, the place of his birth is responsible for his wealth in a certain sense. And the other is that he owes allegiance to South Africa. What do you make of that, Terence?
Well, look, given that he left South Africa when he was, 18 or 19 years old, I think it's a bit of a stretch. I can't help seeing echoes of the story of the little red hen, who will help me gather the grain, who will help me mill the grain. Everyone says no until it's time to eat the bread. Looking at the minister's tweet, I'm also reminded of the approach that the government has adopted towards immigrants since the 1990s, that they're unpatriotic and better off without them. Unfortunately, you know, you lose some of your you lose some of your best people to this. You know, we had a Wunderkind in the form of Mark Shuttleworth, but you know, he also found that South Africa was a tough sell to do the kind of business that he needed to do. And I seem to remember the South African Communist Party having some harsh words for Mark Shuttleworth about, you know, we're not going to surrender to capital and whatever. Well, you know, okay, fine. I also you know, as it concerns concerns opportunities and allegiances. Someone like Mr. Rupert, you know, doesn't always do himself any favors with his with his media handling. But he has been turned into the poster child of everything that is evil. Even though apparently he is the country's largest a single individual taxpayer. That's aside what gets paid through his through the companies he owns. And he said, you know, he is sick and tired of being labeled primeval and white monopoly capital. You know, I imagine that, you know, Elon Musk probably if he's even dimly aware of the existence of Derek Hunter-Korn, would probably, you know, give a quaint smile and move on. No, you know, if I remember what Frederick Douglass said about antebellum America, about, you know, how the country that claims his allegiance is also one that doesn't recognize his humanity. Now, it's obviously a little bit different, it's not quite as extreme. But, you know, if we want people to love the country has to be made lovable. If we want people to put their money in, it has to be made stable and profitable. Appeals to patriotism, I just don't think work.
Right. And, you know, we see this often from the South African left, of a kind of grumpiness about the fact that you know, they can't simply command capital and investors and the wealthy and the successful and all that to do exactly what they want them to do. As, you know, muttering about an investment strike is something that sometimes comes out of government. And, you know, we're really owed this because actually, you know, you guys would be nothing without us, which I think is a bit of a silly thought. Anyway, interesting stuff. Let's go on to our final thing today. And this was a statement yesterday by Finance Minister Tito Mboweni. He reiterated that he did not want strings attached to any help from global financial bodies. Speaking during a webinar organized by Bloomberg, Mboweni was asked about, you know, efforts to get a loan from the World Bank to try and fix the massive debt problem that the South African government has run into. He said, "What I've resisted is any attempt by the World Bank to any policy considerations or conditionalities to us. When we approached the IMF for a $4.2 billion loan, they did not impose any conditions on us. The World Bank was trying to impose policy conditions on us, and I won't have any of that," the minister said. "I think we are edging closer to a common understanding. The World Bank country rep in SA has requested a meeting to discuss their approach. What I think is the World Bank's attempt to impose policy conditionality on us. There will be no policy prescriptions for SA and the World Bank now, and the World Bank now understands that." Now, Terence, if I go to a bank, they'd ask to see my credit record, and if I tried to take a loan. Isn't it kind of a bit silly that Tito thinks that we can do the same thing with much larger sums of money from the World Bank?
No, look, I think he's essentially posturing. You know, it's the great South African financial advice, nothing for Mahala. If we are in a position that we are looking for large scale credit, there are going to be some conditions, then implicit or explicit, but we're not going to get to just to just walk away from them. I think in his moderate defense, he's probably posturing for the benefit of his own party. You know, I won't be pushed around by international monopoly capital or whatever. But I think he's very aware that whether it's through some sort of loan conditions, or simply because we can't carry on like this. Something has to give.
Herman, what do you make of Tito's comments? I mean, one could make a very charitable interpretation that he knows that this is posturing and he knows that there's going to have to be some sort of conditions attached to any loans, and yet he needs to make it look to the left wing of the ANC like he is fighting against this and that they're not surrendering any policy certainty. What do you think of what Tito's trying to do here?
Well, if that's the charitable interpretation, then I think we really are up Excrement Creek without much of a paddle. So I think what Tito Mboweni here is doing is similar to a drug addict saying that they need help and they have no money for food or housing. But if someone is going to give them money, they will not promise not to spend it on drugs again. That's the level of petulance we are dealing with here. So either Tito Mboweni feels that he needs to grandstand to the little commissar idiots in the ranks of the far left of the ANC. I'm sorry, far left there is an unnecessary qualifier in the ANC. In which case that is worrying because, as we know, he might be a good man, he might be a mediocre chef, but he has the spine of a piece of garlic. So that's the first, you know, either that's the situation where we have this grandstanding of a nice but impotent political figure, or he genuinely believes what he's saying, in which case we are stuck with a drug addict that says he can stop when he wants to. So in either case, it doesn't really leave us with much room to maneuver. And the government can be sure that, as we contacted through many hundreds of channels, the IMF and crucial IMF donor nations, and as we had a global engagement with IMF donor nations, we will be launching very, very soon exactly the same approach with the World Bank. We know from behind the scenes that due to pressure from organizations like the Institute of Race Relations, those IMF covert assistance negotiations really, really was 50-50 until the very end. And Mr. Mboweni might be right that there were no conditions attached, but there were specifically stern warnings attached to and the IMF support for South Africa, conditions or warnings, unlike any other, form of explanatory text or context that for any other beneficiary of support from the IMF, similar to what we got. So if we're going to be charitable, Mr. Mboweni is naive and impotent. If we are going to be cynical, Mr. Mboweni is deluded.
Right. I think there's an element here of how Tito Mboweni is playing it fast and loose. So, as you said, there were warnings attached to that IMF loan. And also, it wasn't a standard IMF loan. It was a bailout for countries whose economies had been absolutely devastated by COVID and lockdown. So, you know, the World Bank mustn't give us conditions when it's actually a different, it's not an emergency bailout in the sense that, oh, you've had a horrible thing happen to you. We're asking for money to save us from ourselves, which is actually quite a different ball game, I think. Any final words on this, Terence, before we wrap up?
I can't help noticing a symmetry between what Mr. Haneke and Mr. Mboweni said. Both of them seem to be labeling under a delusion, whether it's real or rhetorical, that this is all a matter of voluntarism. You know, if only people understood, if only people felt appropriately. But unfortunately, I don't think I think that's a forlorn hope.
Indeed, real reform or we will be bust is is the way we're heading right now. There's no more time for the silly game of pretending like we can dance around and trick everyone into giving us money. Anyway, Herman, 10 seconds. What do you got?
10 seconds. There's no use in the hashtag I'm staying if this is the country we're staying in. Either change the country or change the hashtag to I'm stuck.
Quite like that. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening, and we shall see you tomorrow for the Daily French Show. Have a good afternoon, everyone.